Andrew Steer, President of the World Resources Institute. Andrew, we're coming towards the end of the CAPE 2012 conference on development cooperation in tomorrow's world. One of the things which has been identified as an aspect of tomorrow's world is the emergence of climate finance. You spoke yesterday about what that means for development finance. Is it fair to characterise climate finance as a threat to development finance?
Well, what climate finance is trying to do is make development more possible and prevent possible backward trends. I do think, however, in the current constrained financial environment, some countries will be tempted to take money out of what was for traditional and wonderful poverty reduction and put it into climate finance, take it out of low-income countries, put it into middle-income countries. I think that is a threat. I think that would be a great pity. Now, what we need to do is build a case for continued high levels of poverty-reducing aid. At the same time, we're going to need a larger pot of money overall, and we're not yet doing a very convincing job of demonstrating the need for ODA. Those who are advocating climate finance are currently doing a better job than those who are advocating ODA.
And in your opinion, what can climate finance as a relatively new form of finance learn from development cooperation or aid, which has been around for a while? And can development cooperation learn anything from climate finance?
Well, certainly those who are responsible for climate finance, and of course the term climate finance is defined differently by different people. It includes grants from government, but it includes carbon markets, and many people would say it also includes foreign investment of private companies in green technologies. The plain fact of the matter is the painfully learned lessons of ODA, of the Paris, Accra, and Busan agendas, need to be internalized pretty quickly into those who are responsible for climate finance, especially the official part. At the same time, I think those who are responsible for traditional ODA could learn a lot from those involved in climate finance. There's a much greater political dialogue and enthusiasm about climate finance right now. It's a much buzzier space altogether. There's much more energy in figuring out issues such as how to leverage private money. In climate finance, for example, one of the hottest things that's discussed is how can we use a minimum amount of public grant money in order to achieve the maximum amount of impact on the ground. That's not the way that traditional ODA people have looked at it. And so I actually think that there's some very, very interesting debates to be had on traditional ODA. I mean, obviously, the excitement around Monterey 10 years ago or around Glen Eagles in 2005, that has gone. We need to reinvigorate that. The exciting space is now often in the climate world. And so we need to balance that if we're going to get not just to 0.7, but above that.
And many people share an optimistic assessment of the role of poverty reduction efforts in reducing poverty. Do you have an optimistic assessment of the ability of climate finance to address climate adaptation needs?
Well, first, I absolutely share the optimistic view of ODA, and we have to fight against the argument that would say, hey, the last 20 years have been the most successful in history with regard to poverty reduction, therefore the money that we've devoted to that can now be switched over to climate. What we should be saying is because we've been so successful, we now know how to spend money very well on poverty, and we need to spend even more on that. Am I as optimistic about climate finance? Yes, I actually think if you look to see where money is being spent, public money is being spent today on climate change, you're seeing very, very good returns on the mitigation side. Part of the reason is an obsession about results. Climate finance obsessed about results long before those doing traditional ODA. And of course, it's because it's easier because you've got a unit of account, which is a ton of carbon. Much more difficult, of course, on the adaptation side. Intellectually, we've come a long way on the mitigation side in terms of we know how to model it, we know how to look at cost effectiveness, we know how to look at the impacts on the economy. We're probably 8 years behind on adaptation. Even the definition of resilience still needs to be worked upon. And just as the banking system, 20 years ago, invented the idea of stress tests to try and figure out how resilient is a balance sheet. We need something like that to capture the public imagination, so we don't have New York City's suffering $70 billion of costs, as they may well have done in the case of the hurricane last week.
And just finally, you've had a few months now to get to grips with your new role as president of the World Resources Institute. What is it you hope to bring to the table on these issues?
Well, the World Resources Institute is a wonderful institution. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary. We bring serious data and analysis to the table. We then create space for stakeholders, the private sector, governments, communities, civil society, to engage. We have had wonderful successes in the past. We're the keepers of the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, for example. We created the Millennial Ecosystem Survey. We catalyzed the existence of the GEF. We have some wonderful product lines. And what we want to do is bring facts in real time to the people who have to make decisions, and that is whether they are heads of state, ministers, whether they're heads of corporations, whether they are communities. We've long passed the time, unfortunately, when governments alone can be relied upon. The Rio Plus 20 demonstrated to us, you know, in convincing fashion that simply government to government no longer, if ever, it did solve problems. We need creative coalitions. And what WRI is very good at, because of our deep and long association with the major financial and commercial and manufacturing industries and the private sector, together with governments, together with civil society, we want to be part of this new era of sort of mini multilateralism or plurilateralism, with really clearly established goals, identifying leaders, supporting them, and then building coalitions for scaling up.
Andrew Steer, thank you.